this is Mark, and you are listening to Walnut Grove Cast. Today I have a very special guest. His name is Brian Renfro. He's had a very exciting and active career in film and television as a stuntman on such films as The Beastmaster, Death Wish 5, and X-Men, to just name literally a few, as well as an animal trainer on Little House on the Prairie and many, many other productions. Please welcome to the show, Brian Renfro. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I thank you so much for taking the time to come on here and talk to me. I know that the people who are fans of Little House on the Prairie just love speaking to people who spent time on the set and, really kind of were there for the whole gamut, for the whole thing. And just the other day, I was speaking to Lucy Lee Flippin, who played Ms. Wilder. And she was a wonderful interview, and I feel very fortunate to speak to people like her and you and like Sharon Evans and so many others who were just kind enough to put aside a little bit of time to just talk about your experience. Really, thank you.
Well, I enjoy talking this, especially about Little House. You mentioned Sherry Evans, and just to make things clear, Sharon Evans was she was a trainer on Little House before I came on, and after I came on, then she went to other places, and I carried on the show with Bandit and a little crow that I had and a cat and. Various birds and other animals and orangutan and all that
the stuff. Orangutan. Who could forget about the orangutan?
Yeah, that was an amazing thing to work on, because Michael had I brought the orangutan out one day to Simi Valley just to get her used to.
I'm sorry. What bird is behind you? I have to know the name and exactly what kind of bird is squeaking.
Oh, you can hear that, can you?
A little bit, no, and it's fine. I don't think it would. It would be terrible if it was just quiet with no animal noises behind you.
Oh, that's interesting, because my wife is going to take it out of the room, and I said, "Oh no, that's fine," because I can't hear it.
I think it's great.
It's just a little love bird that we have up here.
Oh, okay.
We have two exotic birds. In our bird room down below, but this is just a little lovebird that
who likes to sing.
Loves my wife, and
that's awesome.
Doesn't tolerate me much at all. But
if little happens, birds don't like me.
I'll take them out.
Little birds just don't seem to like me very much. I'm not really sure. I'm not the type of person to go at them really fast. But I don't know. I think they sense my uncomfortability with how fragile birds are.
This little guy was he was not hand raised like we thought in the beginning, and my wife has been spending a lot of time with him, so he's much better with her than he is with me. As far as the orangutan goes, that Michael came to me and I showed him the orangutan that I had brought with me while I was working other animals on Little House, and he really, really liked her. And said, "I'll write us." He says, "I have one more episode to write for this season. Let me put her in it." And he did that, and the whole show was around the orangutan.
Now you thought it was going to be just like a tiny little thing, right?
Yeah, I had no idea what he was going to do, and the show worked out really well, and I was really, really happy to do it, because he allowed me to. Make up a scene for the movie or for the show. Mm-hmm. And I showed him the scene that I had made up, and he loved it, and we filmed it, and it's actually in the episode.
Oh, wow.
What's unique about that is most filmmakers now, directors, producers, people like that, are not going to ask a dog trainer, animal trainer, to go make up a scene for their show. I mean, that takes a lot of confidence in a filmmaker. And Michael was that way. He was He had so much confidence and just the most highly intelligent filmmaker I've ever met. Plus, he had an amazing sense of humor and imagination. I mean, the guy was just amazing. Working for him taught me a lot.
Wow. Was that pretty typical of working with Michael Landon? You know, something where he'll just see an inkling of something and he just kind of runs with it.
Yeah, I think so. The very first day I worked on the show, and I write about this stuff in my book. I'm writing a kind of an autobiography, and I do spend time about Little House on the Prairie, especially Michael. But my first day, I was working a little crow on the show, and the crow had to do something that was pretty tough, and the crow had never been out to Simi Valley, which is full of trees and birds and all kinds of things. And the little crow took off and went up into a tree. And I was like, oh, no, you know, my first day on the set.
Not now, really right?
So here I am, you know, I'm 30 feet up in a tree calling my little crow back to me. And all I can hear is Michael Landon's booming laugh. And I look down and the crew and Michael, nobody's even looking at me. They're not worried at all. He's down there telling jokes to everybody. And so the little crow came, my little crow, his name was Joey. He came back to me and I brought him down. We finished the scene. And a couple weeks later, we were in Sonora, California, filming. And he came up to me and said, hey, I saw the footage of the stuff we shot with the little crow. And I apologize for taking so long to do it. And he said, Brian, don't worry about it. He says, when you want something, you spend the time to do it. And I was like, wow, I was so impressed by this guy because I had just come off 3 years of a TV series that was rather tough to work on, which was called Beretta. And
I know Beretta.
And yeah. Working for Michael was just the greatest thing.
It was just a different universe, huh?
Oh, please, yeah.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned your book. So you do have a book called named Casey, which do you talk about your Little House days in that book?
No, that was Casey was a fictional story that I wrote based on a film dog that I had.
Oh.
And after he passed away, I wanted to I just wanted to keep him alive. And so I wrote a fictional story about him. The book itself was edited down more than I wanted. There's more of a story to it, but that's where that story came from. But the one I'm writing now is a lot of people have said, you know, especially my wife, you should really write about your life, having done all the things you've done, you know, bad childhood, gang life, Vietnam. Animal training, stunt work, you know, and all the ups and downs of all those things. So that's what I'm doing now.
Yeah, you and I spoke about a week ago, and it was you shared some of the stuff that you're working on and writing, and it just seems it's very exciting. It's very personal, and I don't know. I think that you'll find tremendous success with sharing such details. And it's something that I definitely look forward to. I will put a link to Casey, though, in the show notes as well as on the website, so people can check that out. But also, when your future book is done, I'd love to even have you back on the show and talk about your experience. And
absolutely,
you know, put a link, of course.
Absolutely, I'd love to do it. I like telling people. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to write this in the beginning was to maybe help people who have a tough life or don't know how to get out of the bad things they were in or that they are in. And my book starts off pretty much that way. You know, I was in trouble as a youngster in the gang life and stuff, and at one point, I knew that I had to get out of that, and the only way to do that for me at the time was join the Army, and of course, that's when the Vietnam War was going on. So, you know, I mean, it was doing that was a very smart thing on my part, It really helped change my life. Fortunately, I made it out of there in one piece. And
yeah, I was going to say, when did you when did you decide to go into the military? Like, how far were we into? I mean, we're pretty far into the war, from what I can gather.
I went in 1968.
Hmm. I mean, it's pretty intense at that point, right?
Yeah, it was. And you know, I mean, it's there's things that come out of a situation like that, the trauma that you go through in a war, or anybody who actually goes through major trauma in an accident, or you know, anything of that nature, it leaves a mark on you, and it stays with you the rest of your life. I mean, there's you know, there's, of course, with the Vietnam thing, there's the bad dreams and things like that. Mm. And not being able to sit with your back towards a window, that kind of stuff. But for me, like I say, fortunately, I made it out in one piece. And even though there's, you know, I have repercussions from the war itself and the area I was in, I am fortunate that I did do that, and it helped me move my life on. So that's what I would like to talk to, especially younger people. The younger people who are in trouble, mm-hmm. drugs and hanging around with the wrong people, and you know, a lot of them figure that they have no way out, and they do. I mean, there is a way out if you want to work at it, work hard at it. And I mean, I paid a heavy price to get out of what I was in,
mm-hmm.
But it was well worth it. And I would do it again. And I'd like to help people, maybe just talk to people, especially young people, and say, hey, man, I know I was there. I did what you did. Here's what I did to get out of it. You could do the same thing, man.
Right. It's a real situation. It's not like, you know, hey, you know, it's not just something that is just a thought. It's an actual action that you took that, you know, you reversed the way you were going. And, you know, I think
it wasn't easy. I'll tell you, I enlisted right away in the Army Airborne, and they just said no.
Wow.
And so I volunteered for the draft. And of course, at this point in time, you know, the Vietnam protesting was in full swing. The war was in full swing. People were burning their draft cards, and
here I figured, you are, well, okay. Cutting the line.
Yeah, here I am. Yeah. And so I finally got drafted, and they gave me a nice going away party at work and all that. And I went down to the induction center and got off the city bus. And by the time it was all over, they sent me home, said, no, we're not taking you. Now, I had just quit my job.
Oh, man.
So I was like, oh, come on, man. You know. And then 6 months later, I had stayed out of trouble. And they said, okay, come on down. And I did.
Wow. And you came back. So, I mean, so going into the military was really the big step away from the problems that you were having.
Yeah. And the reason being, it gets you out of the neighborhood and away from those people.
Right.
And then it allows you to be introduced to other people from other parts of the country with other feelings and, you know, other thoughts and other ideas, and you learn discipline. And it was just all around really, really, really good for me. I learned about a lot about who I was and that helped me a lot, later on in life, just going, hey, you know what? I made it through that. I know I can make it through this.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you definitely went into, you know, even reflecting back, you know, it was one of the most active wars that the United States had ever been involved in. And thank God you came home, but, you know, I thank you so much for your service. That's
well, that's courageous, I really appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, it was a very ugly war. It was not a popular war.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, when I came back from Vietnam, you know, I was spit on and called a baby killer, and people hated us, and you know, we didn't get it kind of a welcome when we came home.
Wow. And we hear about these stories, and it's almost as though time has softened the way that history presents it. You know, I feel like people kind of really forgot the way that that people came back to the war, you know, with a big middle finger in their face, you know.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's when I went, I mean, I wanted to have a better life. I knew the only way I could do that is by serving in the military. And I had no idea what the situation was like in Vietnam. Before I went to Vietnam, I really didn't know anything about it. I didn't watch the news, you know, I didn't do any of that. So it was a real eye-opener when I got over there. And
sure.
It's not till years later after you come back that you realize how bad the war was and how bad it was for just the regular Vietnamese people who lived there, who, you know, they, most of them in South Vietnam where I was, I mean, they just wanted to grow rice and raise the pigs and have a nice life. They didn't want the Viet Cong coming in. They didn't want us coming in. You know, and of course we went in there and harassed them during the day, and the Viet Cong came in and harassed the same village at night. And I just felt so bad for those people in it, but it took years for me to figure all this out after I came back, you know?
Yeah. You know, I have a very close friend who, he travels to a lot of different Asian countries, and he met a girl in Vietnam, and, he went there and they got married, you know, not just like, you know, not in a, you know, over the course of time, you know, they built a relationship.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And he's, you know, a white guy living over in Vietnam right now until she can settle up, you know, and come here legally. And, you know, he really loves, you know, in a lot of ways, because I don't know if you ever returned, but it's a very different place, of course, than,
no, yeah.
But he loves, yeah, you know, he really loves the culture, and he loves, he sends me photos, and it seems as though it's a really, really, lovely place. I mean, of course, when you were there, this was, you know, it was turmoil. But, you know, decades later, you know, of course they rebuilt it, and, you know, it also the dollar is worth so much more there. You can really live really well there for very little.
Well, they've, you know, Vietnam's come a long way since then. It's amazing that, you know, they're, I mean, that we go over there, we do business with them. It just goes to show you that, that was just honestly a big waste of time.
Yeah, that's what I – but, you know, that's not your fault. You know what I mean? Like, it was just you were there serving the military, you know, with the military. It's not – you know, you didn't make those decisions. But I think a lot of people blame the soldier at the end of the day, and it's really, you know, it's out of your hands.
Could be. Of course, you know, I
– Except for you. You know, you're like, let me go, let me go.
Well, of course, I grew up watching John Wayne, and sure. I mean, you know, you're an American, we're at war, you go fight, you know.
So you came back. Did you foresee getting involved with the entertainment industry when you got back?
No, which is funny in a way, because my father was much older. I think he was in his 50s when I was born. Wow. He was a stuntman extra in the Sunbeam comedies that they did in Florida before they moved to Hollywood. And then when everything moved to Hollywood, he became an animal trainer. And he did Daisy and the Dogs on the Dagwood Blondie series, Asta on the Thin Man. He worked on National Velvet. I mean, he did a lot of movies and stuff back then. And of course my mom was in vaudeville. That's where she met my dad.
Wow.
She was a trick roper, acrobat and dancer, and she had done some film work. And I grew up with this, with my dad doing the dogs and stuff, but it was never anything I ever thought about doing whatsoever. Once I was out of the Army, I went back to my old job. And I got into a motorcycle accident, and they laid me off. And my uncle at the time was doing the show up at Universal Studios in the Tour Center. And he gave me a job cleaning cages. And with what he paid me and what I got from unemployment, I was making $50 a week. And that's what I did. I just cleaned cages. And one day I said, I want to train something. And that just went from there. I just started training things.
So you you basically learned how to train from your dad to begin with?
No.
Or, oh.
No.
Is it just like the natural thing, you think? I mean, it's do you think it's like in your DNA in a way to kind of, you know, communicate with animals in a lot of ways? I think it takes a special person.
In my book, I did write when I was talking about my dad how one of my biggest regrets is the fact that I've never been able to talk to him about stunt work and animal training and how it was in his day and how it was in my day. I'm sorry that I never got that chance to do that with him.
It's not something that's very well documented, actually.
No, it's not. Believe me, I've been doing research on China, you know. Mm-hmm. But there again, I don't know. You know, I just grew up, and when you say animal training is it's not really, it's something that you can learn some of it, but there's also animal training is common sense, and some people who are very smart and just don't seem to have a whole lot of common sense, and you need common sense to train animals.
Yeah, I don't know if I have common sense because my two dogs don't pay any attention to me.
And patience is a good thing too.
I try my best to have patience. There's one, I just think he has some type of learning disability because he's a poodle and he just looks at me kind of like, what, you know, I'm gonna pee wherever I want to pee.
Well, you there know. You go. I mean, you know.
No, but he's nice. I think he's getting better.
Most people don't take the time.
Yeah,
to work with their dog, and really, that's all it is. It's easier for people to put a collar on their dog, tie them up outside, not have to deal with them, and then they wonder why if they do bring the dog in the house, you know, well, this dog's no good. He just jumps all over people. Well, maybe if you spent some time and trained him a little bit, he wouldn't do that.
Yeah, exactly. And and these little tiny dogs we have 10 times the energy, it seems, than the big dogs. But I have a 10-year-old who chases them around, so, you know, they're good dogs. I have two good dogs. He's a little nervous little dog. He weighs probably 6 pounds.
hey, can I tell you, like to tell you a quick story about Little House.
Yeah.
Your fans would probably really like this, but I back in the day when I was working on a Little House on the Prairie, I had a new Chevy van that was in the 70s. It was all fixed up, and I had a PA system on it. Mm-hmm. And we were in Sonora, California, and it was right around Christmas time. And on a Sunday, we all went and played football, all the crew.
Oh,
and all the kids came down.
Really, really cool. The cast, dude.
Yeah, well, it was a crew that played football, but all the kids from the cast, you know, the Melissas and everybody else, they came down and watched the game. Wow. And then after the game, they all piled into my van. And what I did was just drove real slow down the streets of Sonora. And Melissa Gilbert and Melissa Sue Anderson were on the microphone saying to everybody from Sonora, from all those kids on Little House on the Prairie, Merry Christmas.
Oh, man.
And then they would sing Christmas carols.
Wow.
And so I just drove through the town real slow with the kids singing. It was one of the most amazing things.
How cool is that? Wow.
Yeah, it was really, really neat.
Wow, that's really, really wow, that's a really cool story, actually.
You know, and Jason Bateman was on the show, and mm-hmm. I had met Jason before I did Little House. I was in 1975. I was doing a movie with my Golden Eagle, a low budget movie in Utah, And the writer-director was a gentleman named Kent Bateman. Mm. And his kids would come up and visit him, and his kids were Jason and Justine. And so I got to know Jason pretty well then. And as a matter of fact, that was the very first stunt I ever did was on that movie. And after that, when I saw him again on Little House, we kind of renewed our friendship. And then I worked again with him. Yeah, he did another show called Valerie that I worked a dog on from time to time. And we became friends on that. Now I haven't seen him in, you know, forever. And it's and same thing with Melissa Gilbert. I feel bad that I dropped out of contact with them because Melissa and I were pretty good friends when she was younger. As a matter of fact, we were ice skating one night in Sonora, and she fell down and broke her arm.
Oh, that's right. I've heard the story of her breaking her arm. But you were right there.
Yeah. We were doing a whiplash thing. Oh, man. And
It's just so, one of those things where it's like, you know, the entire infrastructure of Little House on the Prairie needs to be adjusted now because she has a broken arm, you know.
Well, and you would be surprised. I mean, Michael handled it so well. It was never missed a step in filming. Michael right away hired a really, really, really good photo double. And so the photo double would walk in and then say you're looking through a window of a structure and you see Melissa Gilbert coming, Laura, and it's actually the photo double. And then as she passed out of eyesight just before she walks in the door, Melissa Gilbert was standing there and she'd walk in and the camera would be above the cast and, you know, did the until she got the cast off, that's the way they worked it.
Wow.
But yeah, Michael didn't miss a step.
I also want to mention, now The Crow was yours, right? The, I'm forgetting the name of the episode. What other animals did you work with that that people might work
on that
with?
Show? I had a black cat that I forget all the stuff that he did. Of course, a crow, and of course, working bandit also. Mm. And as a matter of fact, did a scene, and I think Ray Bolger was in this. You remember him?
I know the name. I'm trying to place it.
Wizard of Oz.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Well, he was one of the guest characters. So. I'm not sure which. I think so.
I'm on it now. I'm looking it up.
I think so. I'm pretty sure it was this episode that he was in. But the dog and the dog had to chase the black cat, and the black cat jumps in the window of this somebody's house there. I forget whose it was. And then and Bandit chases the cat and they both hit the table and slide off the table, destroy the house. And it was,
he was in two episodes actually. And with that same, playing the same character, Toby. No, he did play the Scarecrow in Little House. I mean, I'm the Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Wow. And he was on Beretta as well.
What's that?
It says here he's listed in 1978 as being on Beretta. For a one-off.
Really?
Yeah. The Just for Laughs episode. IMDb blows me away, you know?
I know. I know. It's funny, but in writing the book that I'm writing now about myself, I'll go on there and look up my credits and go, oh yeah, I got a good story about that movie.
Well, you have a laundry. Holy cow, you have a very, very long IMDb page. You've worked on, I've seen so many of these movies, and you even worked on two productions that I worked on, for Scholastic Entertainment called Goosebumps and Animorphs.
Right.
And that really blew me away. Now you were working with animals and working with stunts at that point, right?
Yes.
That's being really wearing many hats. I mean, It's a lot of stress.
Well, yeah, you try, you know.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I did when I was in Toronto was where I did most of my stunts, mm-hmm. and I was living up there for years. And I just noticed that they didn't have there wasn't the same kind of the same quality of dog training in those days in that area.
In Toronto? Yeah. They filmed it there. They filmed everything there because it was just cheaper to film. And in general, yeah, I mean, you could probably step it up with some real quality stuff, like, you know, bringing in like a seasoned professional to do the training, like such as yourself.
Well, that's it just lacked a lot of the trainers up there just did not have the exposure that I did to the people I had when I was growing up in the business. And I'm talking like people like Frank Kent, who did Benji, Beverly Hillbillies. And I mean, he was one of the best film trainers of all time. And I got to work with him and a lot of other ones, and I learned a lot from them. So when I got a dog up there and trained him up, and he did a lot of work, and that's how I started getting these other shows. The production manager on Goosebumps was also the production manager on Animorphs.
Mm.
And she called me one day. As a matter of fact, me and the boys were in Mexico playing golf. And she called me one night in Mexico and said, I got a show coming up and I need a golden retriever and a cat that will work together. And I didn't have anything. And I said, well, as soon as I get back, I'll round them up and train them for the show. You know, and she said, okay. We made a deal right there, you know.
And, you know, I remember in the show there being this cat and this dog that got along very well.
Yeah, they did a lot of stuff. We did one night shot where the dog and the cat are running through the woods with people chasing them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of a tough shot, especially when you're talking about a cat. But what I had done in training, I just figured that this was going to happen. So in training, I basically just trained the cat to follow the dog, knowing that I was going to have to do these long running shots. And so that's what happened. You know, the cat would just follow the dog because there would be a nice little paycheck at the end of the run.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's so funny the way you put that. Yeah, I mean, well, however,
none of us work for free.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, it might be currency for us, but it's treats for them, like a can of tuna. Yeah. Or something. But you know, you did work on so many other really big movies. I mean, so many like really big movies, such as X-Men, Blues Brothers 2000, even, you know, it was such a big production.
Yeah,
you know, it's The Incredible Hulk, you know, even Fringe, which is ironic because my son and I are just starting to watch Fringe. I watched it when it was on, but he wants to kind of jump into it. But Max Payne, this was another movie that was really, really, I don't know, really, really pushed, it seemed. And Resident Evil, you know, it really is. I recommend everybody go and check out your IMDb page and check off all the movies you've seen, because I guarantee you've seen at least maybe people have definitely seen several of your movies.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. A lot of people say, you know, what movies have you been in? You know, would I recognize you? And more often than not, it's no, you wouldn't recognize me at all, because you're just a guy in the background getting shot or blown up or whatever, you know.
Most important aspect of some movies, though. like an American Psycho too, you know, that was another movie that was very well received. It still is a big cult film.
That was a very interesting thing for me, because if you watch that segment, I'm playing on a security guard at night, and when he goes on his killing spree, he walks in there, and I have dialogue as the camera is moving. And I have a plate behind my head with an explosive blood pack on it.
Mm.
And he has a gun. So I have to finish my dialogue by the time he hits his mark. The camera has to be in the right place. And then when he raises and fires his gun, I have to at the same time detonate the pack behind my head. Wow. And go dead. And I was, you know, it's one of those deals where there's so many things that can go wrong. And then when you splatter a blood pack on a wall, it's not easy to do take two because you got a lot of cleanup to do, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
but I think it worked really well.
That's the story of, I think, the stuntman's life is a lot could go wrong, you know, and to have it, to do it so flawlessly is incredible.
Well, you don't always, you know, I mean, there's, you have good days and bad days.
Sure.
But, you know,
hopefully
yeah,
nothing
hopefully,
catastrophic yeah. goes wrong. And
yeah, yeah, true enough. You know, I mean, there's times when you go home and you're limping or mm-hmm. You got a cast on or there's something, you know, but you always try to be able to do your job. I mean, and it's funny, a lot of people aren't you afraid of getting hurt? And I think if you talk to most stunt people, the thing that they're afraid of is messing up the shot.
Hmm. That's a good point. I mean, because like you just said, if, you know, something were to happen and you have that blood splatter and that, you know, I'm going to assume whatever's in that is pretty messy stuff. You know, it's like probably a good, at least an hour and a half cleanup before the next shot.
Yeah. Yeah, I did a movie called Crash that
Ooh, I remember Crash.
This was the one in the when was this? In the 90s, I guess?
Just the one with the car driver, the people who were getting off on car accidents.
Weird things, yeah.
Yeah, with yeah. Arquette. I forgot her first.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And an actor Patricia, that I really love.
Yeah. Patricia Arquette and the guy from Law and Order.
Oh, the guy? No, he's from from Blacklist.
Hmm. I didn't see Blacklist, so.
Oh, it's a TV series that I really like. But the director was David Cronenberg,
mm-hmm.
and we in the beginning of the movie, there's a head-on collision. I'm playing Holly Hunter's husband. So Holly Hunter is driving the car. I'm her husband in the passenger seat. Oncoming is another car.
I'm sorry, James head-on Spader, that's his name.
Yes, yes. And so once we do the head-on collision, we bring the cars in the studio, and my job at that point is to be blasted from the car that I'm in through the windshield and then across the other car and into the windshield of Spade's car.
Holy cow.
And stay there, you know, for the rest of the whole scene. And the first time we did that, it was pretty interesting because if that window doesn't blow, I'm going to have a major headache on the first window and then a good headache on the second one.
Yeah, that's terrible.
But our special effects guy, Kavanaugh, was all over it. He was good and had it all done. But the first take that we did worked really, really well. But a piece of foam core came down in the shot at the end of it, and we had to do it again. Well, that is a three-hour setup to clean everything up, re-glue the windshields, get them all ready to go with special effects and everything, you know. So it was a big deal when that foam core came down in the shot. But there you go, David Cronenberg's like Michael Landon, you know. This is what I want. Okay, let's
right.
do whatever it takes, you know.
I remember thinking Crash was a really shocking movie, but I remember loving it. I haven't seen it in a really long time. I loved it.
I wasn't the first time I saw it. I went to the premiere and I was like, oh man, I didn't know what this movie was about.
It's like she's a hole in her leg and what?
You know? Yeah. I just thought it was about, you know, people racing cars and making love. I didn't Ooh. Know it was strange like that.
You didn't know how close it really got with those two topics. You know, when I was a kid, I remember there being. There was a TV show called Voyagers. I don't know if you ever heard of it from the early 80s. And sure. An actor named John Eric Hexham was in that.
Yep.
I'm going to assume you maybe know how he died. It was from a faulty gun that something got into the blank, and he basically shot himself in the head.
Yeah, it wasn't a faulty gun. It was a gun with a blank in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about a blank is, especially back in the old days.
Is that the old days, like the 80s?
That was before then, yeah. I think. They have a projectile that comes out of them. And there's a lot of powder behind it, especially if it's a full load. There's a lot of powder behind it. And you hold that up to your head, and even though there's not a bullet in there, just the explosion itself coming out of that barrel can put a hole in your head. And I think that's what happened to him, which is really a shame. I mean, this is my understanding that is what happened.
That's the public story. He didn't die on Voyagers, by the way. I made it sound like he did. He was on a TV show called Cover Up, where I think he played like a male model or crime fighter or something like
Cover
that.
Cover Up, that's what it was.
But I always liked him as an actor. It was a real shame. It was one of those things. And do you ever get put in a situation? I mean, you're probably very careful. I would imagine all stuntmen or women are very careful when choosing and this type of thing. Was this just kind of a rookie mistake that was made for him? Because he clearly was not a stuntman.
No, my understanding is he did this on his own, playing around.
Oh, really? I was only.
But I could be totally wrong. I don't think it was part of the movie.
I always thought it had something to do with a scene where he's supposed to pull the trigger, but I could be totally wrong.
And so could I.
Yeah. I'm going to look into it a little bit later, but nonetheless, it's a tragedy, and it's something that, you know, it's a terrible thing, but. Yeah, I would imagine that you probably go through all of this type of stuff and try your best not to take those kind of unnecessary risks.
Well, and you try to – I'll give you an example. A buddy of mine up in Toronto, one of the original guys, stunt guys in Toronto, years and years ago, he had a scene to do where he's supposed to get shot in the stomach with a gun with a blank in it. And they were like, okay, yeah, let's do this. And he was like, no, let's – let's shoot this up against a tree and see what it does. And they're like, no, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it.
Man.
No. And so they held it up to the tree and it put a hole in the tree.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So that would have ended his career.
At that point, you just go home for the day, right? It's like, I think you have to process you know, it's one of those.
You change things.
Yes. It's okay. Yeah, immediately.
So, Let's take the blanks out of the gun, and we'll put a bang on the soundtrack. How's that?
Yeah, exactly. Reset everything.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't. Yeah, you have to be careful. They used to say the way to be an old stuntman is to be careful. Hmm. You know, to rehearse, to watch things, see things, make sure they're working. Don't just hop in the rig and go.
Yeah, I mean, when you were most active as a stuntman, because you're active even now as a stuntman, that's when it seemed to be one of those things where, like, The Fall Guy was, like, a popular TV show. And, you know, every kid, I remember being one of these kids where it's like, I want to be a stuntman. And, you know, it was like you were living the life. And you were literally living that particular life. And I'm glad that, you know, you are here to tell the tale. I hope you share a lot of these type of things in your book.
I am. Yeah.
And how far along are you with your book? I mean, are you thinking this year?
I'm rewriting the second draft right now.
Oh, excellent.
So, you know, and as you go through these things, plus I'm still doing research on certain things and finding pictures that I have, like pictures of working the crow on Little House, pictures from Vietnam. You know, there's a lot of stuff to go through and a lot of stuff to do. And so it's you know, especially for someone who's not a seasoned writer like me, you know.
Well, do you find yourself getting bitten by the writing bug? I mean, do you think that this is something that you're enjoying the process of?
I do. And I would love to, to actually be a writer. My inspiration, one of the things that I would think about for inspiration would be Jimmy Buffett. He's one of the few people that have had a top nonfiction and fiction book. And there's a picture of him on the cover of the book he wrote called A Pirate Turns 50. It was about his 50th birthday. Mm. And the shot looks out to the ocean, and he's sitting on the beach with his computer. I think it's on a log or something. And in the background is his World War II amphibious plane that he had. And I'm a pilot, although I don't really fly much anymore. But I looked at that and I thought, wow, what a cool life that would be. If you could be a writer nowadays, you can live anywhere in the world and write. Yeah. You know, you don't have to be in L.A. You don't have to be in New York. You can be on an island. As long as you have the internet, you can write and send your stuff off to your publisher or whomever, you know.
Yeah, I wish you the best of luck with it. It sounds as though you're very passionate about it, and the story that you're telling is just a fascinating one. But Brian, I want to thank you so much for getting together and speaking with me and giving us a little bit of a personal, all of your personal stories about Little House on the Prairie and your exciting career. If you ever want to come back on, you know, I'd love to have you and talk about all of this. And, yeah, I mean, would people, what's the best way to, I guess, follow your career and, like follow it on like say imdb.com, or do you have a website yet?
No, I don't have any of that stuff. Well, I have IMDb, but, mm-hmm. I was talking to a buddy of mine who's written a lot of books, and, I said, hey, Joel, man, you got to tell me how to do all this, social media stuff once I get this book out so I can push it. Yeah. You know, but in the meantime, I go on Facebook from time to time. I don't even go on there much. As a matter of fact, when you were getting a hold of me on Facebook, my wife is the one that told me that you were trying to get a hold of me because I don't go on it that often. You know, it
please thank like your wife.
Political now, and I just don't want to listen. You know, if I want to watch the news, I'll watch the news. I don't need to go to Facebook and watch all the politics. You
know? I hear that.
It's just getting to be so redundant, but it's nice seeing what's going on and who's doing what with the friends that I know in the film business. But I will, and I would love to come back on your show.
Yeah, man.
You know, it's I love talking about these things, and you know, if anybody ever did want to get, they can find me on Facebook until I get all the Twitter and all these other things that I got to figure out.
Cool. And, you know, I'll do what I can to promote, you know, in my tiny corner of the internet. But yeah, Brian, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And, yeah, I hope to speak to you very soon.